The first commandant of the camp, Shigeji Mori, a calm, impenetrable man in his late 50s, who was said to have run a bicycle shop in Manila before the war, seemed either unaware or uninterested in the death rate. Mori had a dignified facade, an air of quiet precision. He wore black-rimmed glasses and kept his clothes immaculate. His neat black hair was filamented in gray along his temples, and he spoke in a carefully modulated voice. Colonel Mori was neither stupid nor baldly mean-spirited, but he seemed impervious to the horror that he left in his wake. He once remarked, "The prisoners are sick because they need more exercise." For reasons that were never apparent, basic medicines that could have readily saved legions of lives, medicines like quinine, emetine, and sulfa tablets, were never made available. 1,000 men died at Cabanatuan in June, another 1,000 in July. As summer dragged into fall, the toll began to level off. The graveyard details buried tens instead of 50s each day. Finally, in December 1942, Cabanatuan reached a gratifying benchmark, its first zero-death day. The camp began to organize itself. Those American prisoners who had engineering predilections took charge. They dug irrigation ditches and septic systems. They spiked the latrines with larvicidal substances like copper sulfate, unslaked lime, and creosote. They staged bug-killing contests and found ways to fly-proof the garbage pits. They declared a jihad on lice and other ectoparasites, boiling their clothes, cutting their hair, and airing out their sleeping mats in the bright sun. As bleak as the circumstances were, any hope of survival dictated that there be some semblance of a society at Cabanatuan. And as in all societies, there was a discernible structure, with elaborate grapevines for disseminating goods and information. Cabanatuan became, in many ways, a tropical enclave of America. A baseball diamond was laid out. The main thoroughfares took on familiar names: Broadway, Fifth Avenue, Main Street. The camp's prime meeting ground became known as Times Square. A morale program was instituted, which included Bible studies, horseshoes, and ping-pong matches. The prisoners formed a camp library and filled it with 3,000 titles that were assembled from God only knew where, dog-eared copies of Twain, Dickens, Poe, and Pearl S. Buck. The books, which first had to pass the Japanese censors, were kept in states of partial repair with strips of canvas, old rags, and rice paste. A former mining engineer named Homer Hutchison built a clandestine radio, a jury-rigged contraption fashioned from a toothpaste tube, an old truck battery, and a crude crystal that was cleverly housed inside a false-bottomed canteen. Hutchison was able to pick up KGEI out of San Francisco, a station that relentlessly broadcast the American viewpoint on the war. KGEI also played music, and it was on Hutchison's radio that a number of listeners first heard a young singer with the unfamiliar name of Frank Sinatra. During their free hours, the prisoners at Cabanatuan did what Americans do instinctively. They formed little groups and clans and held spontaneous meetings all about the camp. The Knights of Pythias gathered once a week, as did the Knights of Columbus, the Masons, and the Elks. Texans, Iowans, and New Mexicans got together. The camp had a musical band, the Cabanatuan Cats, and a troupe of amateur actors put on skits and reviews whenever they could muster the energy. There were fierce chess matches with pieces whittled from carabao horn and gnarled scraps of narrow wood. A.B. Abraham became instrumental in establishing the Carabao Wallow, a cafe where prisoners gathered beneath coconut oil lamps to play bridge and pinochle and drink ersatz coffee made from chunks of charred rice steeped in hot water. In what was facetiously called the University of the Far East, the better-educated officers lectured enlisted men in history, French, and biology. Astronomy was the most popular class of all. Lying on their backs beneath the Southern Cross, students followed the course of the stars and planets, bathed themselves in meteor showers, and took their minds off this world by contemplating others. A.B. Abraham poignantly described the passage of days. "I held time in my hands. I lived minute to minute, and each seemed an eternity. There came a point when I didn't consider myself as being held in a prison camp. I began to look at the inside of prison camp as my home. I would try to insulate myself from my former life. Then something inside me would burst like a dam. I became flooded with thoughts and feelings, memories of my wife and daughters. I thought about my hometown of Lindora, Pennsylvania. Why was I in love with this place when it never did a thing for me? Sometimes I'd look up from whatever I was doing, and I would understand nothing of what was going on around me. Is it really me, rotting here in this bright Philippine sunshine? Is there nothing left of what I was before?